Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. As a pediatrician scientist who develops vaccines and a parent of an adult daughter with autism and intellectual disabilities, today's guest, Dr. Peter Hotez, has had a front row seat on the modern anti-vaccine movement in the United States. For the past two decades, he's been a target of anti-vaccine activists who started in grassroots groups before gaining strength and power through well-organized, well-funded, and highly aggressive organizations. In his new book, The Deadly Rise of Anti-Science, A Scientist's Warning, he writes, in 2021 and 2022, more than 200,000 Americans needlessly lost their lives to COVID-19 because they refused vaccines. I am fearful for the future of our scientific institutions. We must restore the people's trust in science and scientists. Dr. Peter Hotez is professor of pediatrics, molecular virology, and microbiology, and founding dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine, where he's also co-director of the Texas Children's Center for Vaccine Development. Dr. Hotez's group, known as the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development, developed a patent-free, low-cost COVID-19 vaccine technology, which was transferred to local vaccine manufacturers who then produced tens of millions of doses of vaccines for people living in low-income countries. Dr. Peter Hotez is also author of Preventing the Next Pandemic, Vaccine Diplomacy in a Time of Anti-Science, and Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism, My Journey as a Vaccine Scientist, Pediatrician, and Autism Dad. His new book is called The Deadly Rise of Anti-Science, A Scientist's Warning. Hi, Dr. Hotez. Thank you so much for your important work over the years, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Rose. Thank you for having me.
Well, before we dive in and talk about your book, and it's so important, can we just talk about the work that you and your colleagues did at the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development? I feel like we're barely talking about COVID anymore. And this was such an incredible innovation, thanks to the work that you and your colleagues did.
Oh, thanks for asking. Yeah, my big passion has been finding ways to see if we can bypass the big pharma companies to develop low-cost, sometimes patent-free vaccines for the diseases that the big pharma companies would not ordinarily be interested in. So I started with as an MD PhD student 40 years ago at Rockefeller and Cornell in New York, developing a human hookworm vaccine, now showing protection 40 years later. So we're accelerating that, and vaccines for schistosomiasis and Chagas disease. I call them the most important diseases you've never heard of. They're actually very common, but exclusively affect people who live in extreme poverty. Finding ways to accelerate those vaccines and get them into arms. And then around more than a decade ago, we started developing coronavirus vaccines because we had gotten approached by a group that said, hey, you know, those parasitic disease vaccines you're making are not the only ones that are orphaned. So are coronavirus vaccines. No one cares about vaccines for SARS. If you remember, that was the original coronavirus pandemic in 2002, came out of southern China, severe acute respiratory syndrome, then MERS, Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome. So we used our same low-cost approach through recombinant protein production, microbial fermentation, and yeast process. Been around a couple of decades. That's the process used to make the hepatitis B vaccine that most American kids get. And we were making a lot of success with that. And then when the COVID-19 sequence came online in January 2020, we pivoted and started using that same approach to make a low-cost, patent-free recombinant protein COVID vaccine. It worked beautifully in challenge studies in a non-human primate model with Emory University. We showed that. So we knew it was a great vaccine. The problem is we were cut out of Operation Warp Speed because we weren't a big pharma company. But our passion was global health, and so we partnered with some of the big vaccine producers in low- and middle-income countries, Biological E in India and Biopharma in Indonesia, and made vaccine technologies that reached 100 million people in those countries. So we provide a proof of concept that you don't have to be a big pharma company to do that. In fact, our COVID vaccine for Indonesia was one of the first halal COVID vaccines because we use a vegan process, no animal cells, human cells, animal protein, human protein. So it was really an amazing opportunity to make that contribution and save so many lives.
Why were you not included in Operation Warp Speed?
We were not on their radar screen. We were, the thinking was that, there were two issues. One, the thinking was only the big pharma companies have the chops to pull this off. And how could a research institute based at Baylor College of Medicine, Texas Children's Hospital, have that same level of sophistication? But we'd been developing vaccines for decades. And then I think there was so much innovation and focus on speed and innovation. And all anybody wanted were new technologies, mRNA and particle vaccines. And we got some really interesting technologies, no question about it. We advanced the field. But nobody had that situational awareness to say when you only focus on a brand new technology like mRNA, there's a learning curve before you go from zero to the 15 billion doses that were needed. And what happened was predicted and predictable. And just enough doses were made to be bought up by the U.S. and Canada and Western European countries and Japan. And that left all the low and middle income countries out in the cold. And we said, wait a minute, we've got a technology that we can partner directly with vaccine producers in low and middle income countries. The problem was we didn't get any of the funding from Operation Warp Speed. We had to raise that money privately, which, fortunately we were able to do this time around, and not billions, but, about $7-8 million, enough to do this, and made a huge contribution as a result. I think the message is, I don't think the world's really learned that lesson yet. I think there's still this thinking only the big pharma companies have the chops, and we've got to focus on brand new cutting edge technologies all the time. And it's not true. And hopefully people can learn from this. And now for our hookworm vaccine, which is protecting almost 100% in human clinical trials, we're now trying to see if we can find a way to get some financial help and to scale that up. It'll be the first vaccine for hookworm anemia and only the second parasitic disease vaccine after malaria.
What effect do you think what you and your team did will have in the future, given that you developed this vaccine with no patents and you helped in the technology transfer and the co-development of the vaccine technology to countries like, as you said, India, Indonesia, Bangladesh? How will this help for future diseases in the future, especially in low-income countries?
Well, our hope is people see that there's an important lesson learned. And as I say, you don't have – I mean, it's not to demonize the big pharma companies either. I mean, Pfizer and Moderna and GlaxoSmithKline and Merck and Sanofi provide a lot of important vaccines for the Gavi Alliance and the World Health Organization, but they do what they do. And our point is there needs to be parallel pathways, and we've found one that works, that can bypass the big pharma companies and make low-cost vaccines for the world. So the hope is, now that we've done this and shown that it's to provide a proof of concept feasibility, that people will look at us and tap us for some of our other vaccines that we're looking at now. But, it's interesting. What the exciting part is, there's no roadmap for how you scale up and make vaccines for the world outside the big pharma companies. That's the exciting part. The terrifying part is there's no roadmap. So it's very much learning as we go.
This morning when I logged on to Facebook, I got a memory of a photo getting my first COVID vaccine on this day in 2021. And I was reading your book. I finished it last night. And you wrote that 2021 was such a hard year for you.
Yeah, it was. It was for multiple reasons. Well, one, I was really trying to work furiously to accelerate our vaccines for low and middle income countries. And those who do work with India or Indonesia or the African continent or Asian countries know that to get to them by close of business, you wake up at 4 or 5 a.m. to do the Zoom calls. So after we sent the production cell bank to them, we had to work with them tirelessly to scale up production. And then back then I was, if you remember, I was speaking late into the night to people like Don Lemon on CNN or Lawrence O'Donnell on MSNBC or Rachel Maddow. So I didn't sleep for 3 or 4 years. And then, we're also having to raise the money to make this happen. So it was, and the things that I was speaking to the nation about was so dreary and awful. You know, this pandemic was racing through. And then the biggest nightmare of all, when starting in the spring, summer of 2021, so many people in my state of Texas and other states started refusing to take COVID vaccines because they were told by politicians not to take them, and pleading with people to take those vaccines because they'll save your lives, and watching people perish needlessly because they refused COVID vaccines. It became a uniquely American phenomenon. It was just terrible, terrible to watch.
It was terrible for all of us, just to watch loved ones die and to see this on the news on a regular basis. Beyond what you write about, and we're going to spend the rest of the hour on that, on the deadly rise of anti-science, Dr. Hotez, what do you think we have learned from COVID in terms of, gosh, I just think about even the PPE being made overseas and not having enough masks. You say that we really need to learn more about science, and in some cases, you know, on public radio and other thoughtful shows where you have time to go beyond sound bites, a lot of us actually did learn about science, but of course there's so much more to be learned. But what are your thoughts when you really look back at that time, given that not everyone, because I want to acknowledge people with disabilities, people with long COVID, people who have health issues, who are still masking up, they have not moved on from COVID. I know people want to move on, but many people can't. How do you reflect on that time?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that I noticed when I was doing a lot of public communications, including on national public radio, but also on the cable news channels, was the American people were actually willing to tolerate a lot of complexity. I think, you know, there was always this old school instruction on how you had to talk to the American people about science and talk to them like they were in the fourth grade or the sixth grade. And that's what I was told you had to do. And I said, you know, that wasn't working for me. That's not what I do. I don't talk to anybody like that. I talk to people like they're adults. And provided you don't lapse too much into jargon, the American people were willing to tolerate a lot of complexity and nuance. And that I found was very effective in explaining to people why they're probably going to need a booster down the line, why two doses of an mRNA vaccine is not going to be adequate, why antibody levels decline and you'll need to get boosted, why this virus is mutating and that's why you may need more boosts. And here are the strengths of the mRNA technology. Here are the weaknesses of the mRNA technology. And a lot of people actually appreciated that. I think the other lesson learned was not deferring too much public communications to the big pharma companies. And I think that was a big problem, not putting any constraints on the press releases. Because, you know, when these companies send out a press release, they're not meant for you or for me. They're meant for the shareholders to jack up the stock prices. And they tended to spectacularize their accomplishment, ignoring the fact that COVID vaccines were in development for well more than a decade, arguably 15 years. And that's why the Nobel Prize was awarded to the scientists at Penn for mRNA over 15 years of work, and why we'd been developing coronavirus vaccines, a different technology, for more than a decade. And that was important because the American people knew that's the time frame for vaccines. So by allowing the companies to lead the communications, I think they wound up scaring the American people into thinking, how can, you know, the American people would think, how can these vaccines be legit when they just popped out of nowhere? That's what the pharma communications were, but it wasn't true. It was over a long period of time. So that was an important lesson learned. I think another was the fact that the disinformation campaign that was politically motivated and predatory took on unprecedented proportions. And now we have to realize for the next pandemic that will come, whether it's another coronavirus, we've now been having this regular cadence of coronavirus pandemics every 6 to 7 years, SARS and MERS and COVID-19, there'll be a fourth one likely before the end of this decade, or maybe an avian influenza, is that the technology, our ability to make vaccines, has outpaced our social, political, and financial instruments that we have to get them. And that includes combating disinformation. So, you know, if you look at the level of what percentage of Americans have been taking COVID boosters the last couple of years, whether it was the bivalent one in 2022 or this new XBB annual immunization. Only 20% of the American people have accepted it, even though it will help ensure that you won't get very sick or get long COVID. People aren't buying it and buying into it. And that's what we're going to be facing with the next pandemic, because the disinformation campaign is so strong right now.
Today, we're spending the hour with Dr. Peter Hotez, author of the new book, The Deadly Rise of Anti-Science, A Scientist's Warning. Dr. Hotez is professor of pediatrics, molecular virology, and microbiology, and founding dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine, where he's also director of the Texas Children's Center for Vaccine Development. Dr. Hotez's group developed a patent-free, low-cost COVID-19 vaccine technology, which produced tens of millions of doses of vaccines for people living in low-income countries. He's also the author of Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism, My Journey as a Vaccine Scientist, Pediatrician, and Autism Dad. If you'd like to join us, what questions do you have for Dr. Hotez? He is working nonstop to restore the people's trust in science and scientists. What really strikes you about how the anti-vaccine and anti-science movement really exploded during COVID-19? If you have any personal stories to share, we'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you're a scientist, we'd love to hear about your experiences. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Dr. Hotez, you go into the history of how we got here, and I think this is really important. You cite a book by Chris Mooney. We had him on, I can't believe it's been so long, 2005, The Republican War on Science, where he writes about how Newt Gingrich, when he was Speaker of the House in the 90s, began cultivating contrarian scientists to have them testify to Congress. And that ushered in a period in which science was politicized to support the business community or other national interests. The George W. Bush White House promoted efforts to counter scientific consensus views in a diverse range of areas, including climate change, environmental protection, stem cell research. I remember that one. I'm sure a lot of our listeners do. So can you talk about what struck you when you did your research for this book about the history of how all of this began, especially with politicians supporting people who were speaking out on these issues?
Yeah, and it's the hardest thing to talk about, because all of my training as a physician and scientist, getting a medical degree and a PhD, said, you know, you're not supposed to talk about politics, right? We're supposed to be politically neutral. We're not supposed to care about Republicans or Democrats or liberals or conservatives or red states or blue states. But you know, what do you do when a major political party adopts anti-science platforms? And the climate scientists have been dealing with this now for well over a decade. I talk a lot to my colleague Michael Mann, who's a climate scientist at the University of Pennsylvania. And then about 7-8 years ago, the far right adopted this anti-vaccine platform out of this concept, this propaganda concept of health freedom, medical freedom. And it really took hold in Texas. The anti-vaccine groups started getting PAC money from the Republican Tea Party, Political Action Committee money, to convince Texans not to take childhood immunizations. And we're raising money for candidates to actually run on anti-vaccine platforms. I mean, it made no sense. Why adopt this platform of all the things to adopt, you know, something so harmful as convincing parents not to vaccinate their kids? And there was the earlier assertions that vaccines cause autism, and that's how I got involved in it, because I'd written the book Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism. So that had given me that front row seat. But now it took on a new mantle. It got power and money and PAC money to become a fully enmeshed in American politics, and it took off in red states like Texas and Oklahoma, and I watched in horror as this was starting to happen. And that's what came off the rails during COVID, because and it really took off during the CPAC conference of conservatives in Dallas in 2021. where the rhetoric was, first they're going to vaccinate you and then they're going to take away your guns and your Bibles. And as ridiculous as that sounds to us, people in my state of Texas accepted it. So what had happened was, in their zeal to go up against vaccine mandates, they went the next measure and falsely discredited the effectiveness and safety of vaccines. And so they brought on all of these prominent anti-vaccine activists at the CPAC Conference of Conservatives in Dallas in July 2021. And then the pile-on came, and the pile-on was members of the House Freedom Caucus of the Republican Party, people like Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia, said called people like me medical brown shirts, you know, using Nazi paramilitary analogy or Nazi analogies and Holocaust analogies to describe vaccines. And Senator Republican House of Representative Jim Jordan from Ohio, and then Senator Rand Paul piled on with all this anti-vaccine nonsense, and Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, all these phony baloney vaccine injury roundtables. And then it got picked up by Fox News, and this was documented by two groups, Media Matters, a watchdog group, as well as a research group out of Federal University of Science and Technology in Zurich, Switzerland, where Einstein studied, documented how every night during that Delta wave, as the Delta wave was taking off, after vaccines were freely and widely available, they protected 90% against severe illness and death. Laura Ingraham, Sean Hannity, Tucker Carlson filled their broadcasts with anti-vaccine content, discrediting the effectiveness and safety of vaccines. So if you're watching Fox News every night and listening to your elected leaders, you went down that rabbit hole and decided not to get vaccinated. And it was followed on with some of the prominent podcasters like Joe Rogan, and then started bringing on all these prominent anti-vaccine activists and talking up ivermectin as a replacement, which doesn't work for COVID. And this became people's identity not to take a vaccine. They were actually victims of this organized, well-financed, predatory movement. That's why I bristle when we call it misinformation or infodemic, as though it's just some random junk out there on the internet. It's not. It was organized and predatory, and it killed Americans. And so of the 100,000 Texans who died in the COVID pandemic, one of the worst affected states, almost half died after vaccines were available because so many Texans refused to get vaccinated. 40,000 plus unnecessary deaths. And nationally, I put the estimate around at least 200,000 in red states, overwhelmingly, with studies by Charles Gaba, the health analyst, and confirmed by the New York Times and Axios and National Public Radio, showing that the redder the county, as measured by percent Republican voters, the higher percentage of Republican voters, the lower the COVID immunization rate and higher the death rate. So much so that David Leonhardt of the New York Times just called it red COVID. And so this became then a major killing force in the United States. And that's why we have to talk about it, because it's not just some arcane academic discussion or some theoretical thing. This anti-vaccine activism, health disinformation, is now a major lethal force in the United States. And to bring this back, you know, I say, look, I don't care about your political views. That's your right as an American citizen. But, you know, don't adopt this one, because it's such a killer. So the question then becomes, how do you uncouple the anti-science from all of the other things that are espoused on the far right, whether it's around the election or Putin or whatever? I don't care about that. I just don't want you to engage in lethal and dangerous health behaviors like refusing vaccines. And it's a tough needle to thread, and and I'm getting beat up pretty heavily because of it, but I think it's an important thing to say.
At the end of the day, you don't want people to die, and you don't want people to get diseases.
Absolutely. I gave medical grant. I do a lot of teaching. I give medical grand rounds in Tyler, Texas. They have a new medical school, very conservative part of Texas. And basically, all these people you talk to have lost loved ones because they refused a COVID vaccine. And I'll never forget, a few weeks later after doing that, I gave medical grand rounds at Stanford, which is, of course, an amazing medical school. And I said, you know, if my car had broken down in East Texas versus Palo Alto, California, I'd probably pick East Texas, because people would be fighting over who's going to help you change the tire. And people laughed a bit and I said, so, you know, these are amazing people, but they were victims. They were victims of this predatory campaign from elected leaders on the far right and Fox News and the podcasters. And how do we prevent that from ever happening again?
It's so sad, Dr. Hotez. In your book, you write about how a lot of these high-profile Republicans or pastors were on their deathbeds because of COVID. And some of them said, I regret not taking the vaccine, or can I have it now? Of course, that would do nothing, unfortunately.
Right.
But some of them still, I mean, they died still believing this information.
Yeah, their last dying breath, you know, they couldn't even die with dignity. Their last dying breath saying this is all a hoax. And that's how powerful health disinformation has become and how dominant it's become. And what's almost as equally tragic now is you see those same elected leaders who actively encourage people to die by telling them not to get a COVID vaccine now doubling down. And this is playing out now in these awful House subcommittee hearings on COVID-19. You know, the rhetoric was, well, you know, it wasn't COVID that actually killed Americans. It was the COVID vaccines, absolute nonsense, or that the scientists invented the coronavirus through gain of function research, also absolute nonsense. What they're basically doing is, now that I've called them out, others have, and they're doubling down and they're trying to revise history. And hopefully it won't work. But it's, again, it's just more health disinformation piled on more health and science disinformation.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Peter Hotez, who's been a target of anti-vaccine activists for the past 2 decades. He's out with a new book, The Deadly Rise of Anti-Science, A Scientist's Warning. He's also the author of Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism, My Journey as a Vaccine Scientist, Pediatrician, and Autism Dad. Dr. Hotez is professor of pediatrics, molecular virology, and microbiology, and founding dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine, where he's co-director of the Texas Children's Center for Vaccine Development. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. In his new book, The Deadly Rise of Anti-Science, A Scientist's Warning, today's guest, Dr. Peter Hotez, writes, this was not an easy book to write because it recounts both painful personal experiences and the suffering of others. For the past 2 decades, I've been a target of anti-vaccine activists who started in grassroots groups before gaining strength and power through well-organized, well-funded, and highly aggressive organizations. I'm fearful for the future of our scientific institutions. We must restore the people's trust in science and scientists. If you have any questions or comments for Dr. Peter Hotez, if you'd like to talk about how you're reflecting back on COVID and where we are right now with this rise of an anti-science movement, we're also going to talk about the funding. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Dr. Hotez, before the break, you were talking about some of these Republican politicians who spoke out against masks, spoke out against vaccines, and they're still in power. And this is dangerous. As you say, we're talking about people's lives here. What are your thoughts about how this should be covered, given that we are in the 24/7 election cycle already? And some of these people are running. I mean, Donald Trump is running. How should these issues be covered in the media? And what are your overall thoughts about how major media focuses on these topics?
Well, you know, you certainly have, you know, the far right media, you know, the Fox News, the Murdoch-owned Wall Street Journal opinion pieces just still out there hammering away and doubling down, trying to change history and covering their tracks and saying, no, it wasn't us who told Americans not to get vaccines. It was because the scientists communicated poorly, and it was, you know, or they'll say it was the vaccines that killed Americans, or that the scientists invented COVID. So it's a big cover-up attempt. But the other thing that you see happening quite a bit is even the mainstream media is kind of giving this kind of false equivalency, you know, saying, you know, trying to part blame the scientists for how they communicated, and the communication wasn't perfect. But overwhelmingly, it was because it was weaponized by bad actors. You know, they're trying to give equal weight to the zoonotic origins of COVID, which clearly it was, versus gain of function research, which has been discredited. But the mainstream media, a lot of the editorials coming from the editorial board still kind of weigh those two equally. So we're seeing a lot of that as well. And nobody's holding elected leaders accountable. I mean, I think, Senator Rand Paul, Ron Johnson, members of the House Freedom Caucus in concert with Fox News, contributed to the untimely deaths of Americans. Where's the censure? Where's the reprimand in Congress for this kind of behavior, for basically killing Americans? And that troubles me, that it's all been sort of pushed under the rug. And by the way, we're not hearing also from the White House, which is disappointing. The White House Office of Science and Technology Policy is silent. PCAST, the President's Council on Science Advisors, is silent. We're not hearing from our scientific society. So, it's not just the words of the enemies, it's the silence of the friends that also troubles me as well. So, unfortunately, it just leaves a handful of us out there to take the slings and arrows, and there are a lot of them. It's not fun, when Steve Bannon publicly calls me a criminal. I mean, it's bizarre, right? I mean, Rand Paul just makes up all this stuff about me. He writes an entire book about me and colleagues and just says whatever he wants with no accountability. And it's not good for the country. And so what we're seeing is now this next phase is not only attacking science, but treating scientists as public enemies or enemies of the state. And it's going to have ramifications on the future of biomedical science in the United States. I mean, you may not see it as much where you are in the Bay Area because it's such, in such an enriched area and you don't have that same extremist type of politics. But elsewhere in the country, I can assure you it's having big time effects. And I worry, especially if you're a young person thinking about what you want to do with your life. Why would you want to become a scientist when you're going to be hauled off in front of C-SPAN cameras to be humiliated and are treated like a public enemy, which is what we did with the climate scientist 10 years ago, what we're doing now with the virologist and the biomedical scientist? All for what? For nothing, right? It's all for, on the House subcommittee official Twitter site, it literally says, quote unquote, we're going to sell popcorn. They're not even pretending this is anything other than political theater or Fox News soundbites, but it's happening at the expense of the scientists. And the damage will be felt for a long, long time, I'm afraid.
Let's talk more about this. What are you hearing from your colleagues? As you write in your book, scientists are afraid to speak out because of the issues you just laid out. I mean, you have some of the emails you've received, horrific, violent emails, anti-Semitic emails. I mean, you had to thank the police department because your family needed support and needed to be protected. I mean, we've got so many guns in this country. So this is real fear.
I mean, I've even got my own FBI agent because when they start sending swastikas to the home and have the Houston Police Department in front of my house. So, and there's more and more of that happening. And so I think what we really need is for our elected leaders to speak out and defend scientists. And by the way, I talked with a number of Republican leaders as well. I mean, the percentage of those who are openly working to undermine science is not high. But the problem, again, is the silence of the friends. Everyone's afraid to offend the base. So they're too often silent. I say historically, up until the last 10, 20 years, the Republican Party has not been necessarily anti-science. Abraham Lincoln started the National Academy of Sciences and Eisenhower launched NASA. This is something kind of new and twisted, and it's hurting us. I mean, the United States is a nation built on the strength of our great research universities and institutions, right? That gave us the Manhattan Project and Silicon Valley. It gave us the war on cancer and the moonshot. And that's why people admire the United States, because of our research universities and institutions in places like University of California, Berkeley, UC Davis, and UCSF, and Stanford, and you know, Children's Hospital of Oklahoma and the research of Oakland, and you know, there and yet now this is all about, this is very fragile, and I think we're going to see, especially if, depending on how things go with the election and who controls the Senate and the House, we're going to start seeing this dismantling of the infrastructure of the National Institutes of Health and National Science Foundation. It's going to be very damaging.
And the CDC?
And the CDC, of course.
What about government agencies? You write in your book that, and as you say, the U.S. government response to anti-science aggression remains modest. And this is under the Biden administration. The Department of Health and Human Services is focusing its energies on Facebook and social media companies, encouraging to adjust their computer algorithms to reduce the tidal wave of disinformation. I mean, you've got incredible stats here about the lies really shared on Facebook, and then all of these anti-vax books shared on Amazon. What do you think the U.S. government should be doing about this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think, you know, to their credit, they are trying to address this, but it's incremental what they're doing in terms of, you know, Vivek Murthy, you know, tried to, you know, issue a warning saying that the that we need to switch up computer algorithms so this health disinformation doesn't go as viral. And of course, the Missouri Attorney General turned around and sued him. So you had Missouri versus Murthy to try to halt even efforts to stop the disinformation. Or, you know, you have people like Rene D'Arresta at the Stanford Internet Observatory tracking this and efforts to try to halt what she's doing. So that is a concern. But I think it's equally important that we get a very robust statement from the leadership of the Biden administration. I want to hear from the vice president, from Kamala Harris, standing up for saying, no, we're not going to allow prominent American scientists to be humiliated in front of C-SPAN cameras. That's not good for the country or the president, or at least, you know, the offices that have been designed to maintain scientific integrity, like the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, or PCAS, you know, that you have silence there as well. So this is going, and I, you know, I a little bit understand it because I understand it's an election year and the Biden administration would prefer to keep COVID off the radar screen because presumably they feel that's not good for the campaign. But at some point, there's going to have to be a more stalwart effort to stand up for the science and the scientists.
Dr. Peter Hotez is author of the new book, The Deadly Rise of Anti-Science, A Scientist's Warning. In 2021 and 2022, he writes, more than 200,000 people in the United States needlessly lost their lives to COVID because they refused vaccines. Dr. Hotez has been at the forefront of this issue and this movement to ensure that people understand science. He's been the target of anti-vaccine activists for two decades. Not only has he received horrific death threats over email, anti-Semitic emails, but people have actually accosted him when he speaks at events. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have a number of emails, Dr. Hotez, but before we take those emails, I just want to ask you, after you wrote the book about your daughter in 2018, Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism, this is about your youngest daughter who's now an adult, you talk about how the threats and the vitriol really changed. You also talk about how you were able to really educate people about autism and vaccines, and so the anti-vaccine movement had to change their playbook. Can you talk a bit about that?
Right. So the book, you know, that book that I wrote previously, not only does a deep dive explaining the evidence showing that vaccines don't cause autism. By the way, anti-vaccine groups keep on switching up what they mean, because it started with false claims that it was the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. And then Robert F. Kennedy Jr. wrote in 2005, wrote an article in that very important biomedical journal called Rolling Stone, a false claim that thimerosal preservative was doing it. And then it was spacing vaccines too close. I'm joking, of course. then, you know, spacing vaccines too close together, alum and vaccine, it was all BS. And And so, but it became an exhausting exercise to debunk it each time, but we did it. And then they claimed it was the HPV vaccine for cervical cancer, other cancers causing infertility or autoimmunity, also not true. And by the way, if you've heard that from COVID-19 vaccines, that's where they got it from. They just copy-pasted the false assertion from HPV vaccines onto COVID-19 vaccines. But I think, you know, it, and the other part of the book was not only debunking the false claims that vaccines cause autism, but providing an alternative narrative on what autism is and how it begins in early fetal brain development through the action of autism genes. We did whole exome genomic sequencing on Rachel and my wife Ann and I to find Rachel's autism genes and Rachel's autism gene. And a lot of them are neuronal cytoskeleton genes involved in neuronal connections. And that was important to have that alternative narrative. And since the book came out as a brilliant paper by the group at Stanford Medical School Neuroscience showing how neurons that with autism genes are not migrating the same in brain organoids. So we really have a complete description almost of the understanding about the neurodevelopmental processes leading to autism. And that's important because parents, you know, it wasn't enough for parents to say, don't blame the vaccines. They'd say, okay, doc, if it's not vaccines, what is it? And now we have a pretty coherent story on what it is. And I think that did have the effect of undermining the anti-vaccine groups that were monetizing the internet, selling phony autism cures or nutritional supplements that nobody needed, or, you know, selling anti-vaccine books on Amazon, which predominate as the vaccine books that are sold on Amazon. But then they reinvented themselves, and they reinvented themselves as a political enterprise on the far right through health freedom, medical freedom propaganda. And then they even became stronger, and they became, then this is where they started getting PAC money, and they got endorsement at the highest levels of the United States government through members of the House Freedom Caucus, two U.S. senators. And then Fox News adopted it. And, you know, Fox News is 3 million viewers every night. So that's the most widely watched news opinion broadcast. So this became, that's how it gained power, by taking on this political mantle.
To that point, Charles writes, how does the anti-science politics you've discussed interact with the anti-science operations using PR flacks and paid scientists, such as described in the book Merchants of Doubt?
Yeah, so what you started to see is, you know, Fox News would bring on these talking heads to repeat some of the anti-vaccine tropes and makes false statements about vaccines. And unfortunately, false statements about herd immunity. And unfortunately, many of them came from prominent universities like Johns Hopkins or Stanford or UCSF. And even though they weren't specialists in infectious diseases or virology or vaccines, you know, the American people don't know that. They just see it's a professor at Stanford or a professor at Johns Hopkins. And they caused a lot of damage as well. And then with that, you saw this with the health and wellness industry and selling the nutritional supplements. And then they began promoting hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin and would have very expensive telemedicine visits, you know, charging $1,000, $2,000 for a telemedicine visits. And they would send you their prescription for ivermectin or the actual ivermectin itself. And so people accepted that, and unfortunately, this is now becoming more and more mainstream. Even though neither ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine does anything for COVID-19.
Thank you for the email. We have another important question from Andy. Unfortunately, I have a number of old friends back in Canada who are anti-vaxxers, which was a huge shock at first. However, they had always been part of our alternative community who, like me, have a legitimate mistrust of big government and big corporations and pharmaceuticals. I think these folks had become quite disengaged from reading any news or information about national politics and science. So when COVID arose, they didn't have much background or much of a base from which to make rational decisions about vaccines. And more importantly, They weren't very savvy about the internet and the media, so we were unfortunately sucked into the well-funded right-wing misinformation about COVID and vaccines. Very sad, because these are good people whose intentions are good, but who've been fatally misled. There are good reasons for not trusting certain elements of government and corporations, but it's so crucial not to fall into the simplistic notion that they have everything the government that everything the government or corporations tell us is a lie. Dr. Hotez, I think this is such an important comment.
I agree. In fact, that's a very eloquent paragraph that you just read. And congratulations to that person for articulating it so nicely. And there's a fair bit to unpack there, because, you know, I think one of the things we're learning from the social scientists, who those who are readily adopt conspiracy beliefs tend to have pretty low critical thinking skills, and that's important of how do we build that, especially in our K through 12, and how do we get people to know what it means to be a scientist or a working scientist. So, few things on that. One, we've got this problem of the disappearing science journalists. We have fewer and fewer people who are trained in science or have PhDs in science going into journalism. We could use people with doctoral degrees in science to be in our K through 12 in our public school, so they see what a working scientist looks like. And I think too often we're invisible, and by being invisible, it's easier to demonize us and see us as sort of these lurking figures in dark corners with white coats doing nefarious things. My friends at Research America, which is a policy group based in Washington, D.C., does these surveys every couple of years. And the question is, you know, can you name a living scientist? And it turns out about 75% of the American people on average cannot name a living scientist. And those who do, you know, they'll name Bill Nye and Neil deGrasse Tyson, who are terrific, but, you know, they're not working scientists like many of us are, right? Where we're struggling over revising manuscripts and papers for scientific journals, or getting our grants turned down from the NIH or NSF, or presenting at scientific meetings, or what it's like to be at a lab meeting. And so it really says that as a group, certainly the biomedical scientists and most scientists, in terms of a working scientist on a day-to-day basis, are absolutely invisible. The American people don't know what we do or that we exist. And I think that is partly our fault, or partly the fault of university leaders. I think, you know, I'm seeing this as a problem with the college presidents and university offices of communication, that they don't want their faculty and scientists really out there in the public domain. Or what they'll say is, hey, you know, you have academic freedom, you can do whatever you want, dot, 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 but don't screw this up and don't get the institution in trouble. So you kind of do it with, and of course, if you're out there enough, you will screw it up and you will get the institution in trouble. And you have to know that the scientists have the backing of the institution. So I think, and we don't encourage public communication among scientists. And I think that whole culture needs to change. We need to embrace it, if anything, and provide public engagement, communications training in our PhD programs and our postdocs. Now, not everybody wants to do it or should be forced to do it, but I think among young people, a lot of young people do, and it needs to be encouraged rather than being seen as something dangerous or something that'll get the institution in trouble. We've got to get over this kind of risk averseness to doing these sorts of things.
And back to Andy's email, which I think is so important. I mean, as you know, Dr. Hotez, there's reason to be skeptical of a lot of things in this country. I mean, looking at Big Pharma's profits, looking at the pesticides in our food, the lead in our water. I mean, I think a lot about the fact that 6 in 10 Americans live with at least one chronic disease. I mean, that's just unacceptable in a country like the United States, where we have so much knowledge now. But there's, you know, so much information now about how processed food affects us. And so how do we reach those people who can come back?
And look, there's legitimate grievances. I mean, what does Pfizer and Moderna do after taking $25 billion in U.S. taxpayer money for either development costs for mRNA vaccines or advanced purchase? They turn around, they jack up the price to $130 a dose. I mean, I want to say to these guys, I mean, do you want the American people to hate you? I mean, you know, we've... So, so, So that doesn't make it any easier. And it is interesting when I get attacked, you know, the first thing they'll say is I'm a shill for the big pharma companies, even though as we started this broadcast, we made low-cost vaccines that actually bypass the big pharma companies. But that's an inconvenient truth for a lot of people. So there is a lot of work to be done on that front.
Right. And I watched some of the RFK kickoff rally, and the speakers all were talking about these very issues.
Yeah, but and the problem, of course, is RFK Jr. and his running mate are not, you know, honest about what they're saying about vaccines, and they're piling it on with a lot of health disinformation. Every fifth statement may be a partially true fact or factoid to make it all seem legitimate, but, you know, he is one of the biggest promoters of vaccine health disinformation. He does a lot of damage. I've been, you know, going up against him for years, and it's been very frustrating to have to deal with Bobby on this.
Dr. Peter Hotez is author of the new book, The Deadly Rise of Anti-Science, A Scientist's Warning. If you have some time, be sure to read about the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development, where Dr. Hotez and his colleagues developed a patent-free, low-cost COVID-19 vaccine technology, which was transferred to vaccine manufacturers. They then produced tens of millions of doses of vaccines for people living in low-income countries, saving millions of lives. You can learn more about Dr. Hotez and his work at yourcallradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Hotez. We'd love to have you back.
No, you've been amazing, and I really appreciate the opportunity you've given me to talk about this. This is really important, and this is very meaningful. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. That means a lot. We'd love to have you back in a few months. Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, we are going to speak with advocates fighting draconian measures in Republican-controlled states like Florida, where a six-week abortion ban goes into effect on May 1st, or Louisiana, where abortion is completely banned. And lawmakers there are considering a bill that would criminalize librarians for just joining the American Library Association. How are people responding? Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering today's show, and thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.